Welcome to the Audible Genius Podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes look at being a musician. I'm Joe Hanley, and today I'm talking to Artemy Pavlov, an accomplished sound designer and the man behind the innovative music software company, Sine Vibes. We're going to walk through his journey from a lover of synths to a sound designer for well-known audio brands to a music software coder and creator. Let's get started. So, you do sound design and consultancy for other companies, and you have your own plugin company. With your sound design and consultant work, you've worked with some big companies like Spectrasonics, Korg, Native Instruments, and also Roland, where you did some work on some of their big synths and keyboards like VSynth, Phantom G, Jupiter 80. What stuff did you do for those keyboards?
Well, Roland was... The collaboration with this company was pretty much the first thing that I ever did in this whole field. So my sound design career pretty much started with Roland Instruments back in 2003 or 4, I believe. So I've done a lot of stuff basically for the Phantom X, Juno G, Phantom G. I've done presets, and for the VSynth, for instance, I've also done both the presets, I mean the patches, and the factory sample content. So and of course, you know, I did presets for the Jupiter 80, for SH01, a few other machines. I mean, I keep forgetting already. So yes, that's pretty much.
Oh, that's pretty cool that your first opportunity was with a major company like Roland. How did you come across that opportunity?
It was a very, like a multi-step, it happened in several steps. All of them were kind of interesting. I was a huge fan of Roland XP80 workstation, which I had for a few years back in those days. And I really loved, you know, pretty much everything about it. And a few years after I got it, Roland released the Phantom, and then they released the Phantom S, which included sampling. And I was so excited about it because I've been dreaming about, you know, having a workstation with great synthesis capabilities as well as sampling and effects in one box. And I got so excited about it that I've decided to start like a mini community online. And that was very early days of the internet still. There were no social networks and everything was happening on forums, if you remember. Yeah. Those glorious days. So anything you would want to share with anyone, that would have to be on some forum. So that was actually a forum called Harmony Central. I'm not sure if it's still there. And that was like a hangout zone for Roland fans, and I was very, very loud over there. I think I was like 22 at that moment, and I was still a student, and I had no money basically. I just had the XP80, and I had some savings over there, and I still couldn't afford the Phantom S, but I was so pumped about it. There was no such word back in those days, though. It's I was really so excited about this instrument that I was like thinking about it, you know, each and every day. And I started a website called Phantomized, which I probably was phantomized by the instrument. So it was like a fan website, basically, with a few pages like linking to various resources, pictures, YouTube videos, and stuff like that. And you know, all of the stuff that I was gathering on that website really caught, you know, interest of many users, forum users at Harmony Central. And they said, "Hey, why don't you start a forum?" So I actually opened a forum on this website, and it got like 1,000 users in just a few months. It got very, very popular. And I think like at some point, you know, there were so many people there. There were I was actually giving them advice on the forum regarding the instrument, and I because I had a chance to receive the user manual of it. One of the users scanned it for me. He couldn't download it back in the day. Roland would not allow this. So one of the guys over there scanned the user manual for me, which I read. I was a maniac. So and now I knew the instrument better than most people who had it, and I still didn't have it. So long story short, when people found out that I still don't have the instrument because I lack cash to buy it, they actually started like a fundraiser. So they gathered some money so I could sell my XP80, add the money, and buy the Phantom S. So that's how I got it, basically. Wow. Thanks to that community. That was pretty amazing back in the day. And so I started doing like a ton of stuff with it. Sound, you know, custom presets, doing like little productions, demos, playing with effects and resampling and everything. And that website, like I said, it was very popular and it caught attention of Roland. And eventually one of their sound designers, Stefan Pigeon from Belgium, who is a very dear friend of mine now, of almost 20 years, yeah. So, he said, like, hey, why don't you do like a test project for us? Because your sound, the stuff that you do sounds very interesting, you know, the sounds and everything. So the first project that they gave me was the Roland Phantom XA, which was like a simplified version of the Phantom X. And I did one of the factory demos for it. And a few months after that, they said, like, you got accepted or something like that. And I got two projects to work on. That was the VSynth 2.0 and VSynth, the VSynth 2.0 and VSynth XT. So there was like a fresh factory bank for it that we worked on, which included both samples and patches. And there was a Phantom X 2.0 update for which I also did presets. So that was kind of the start.
Wow. Yeah. So you didn't actually have the Phantom X or the user manual when you started talking on the forums a lot and starting the website about it.
Yeah, I was quite a fanatic of reading manuals for some reason. Pretty much, yeah. It was the same thing with the XP80. That was the Phantom S, the model that preceded the X.
Okay.
But they were pretty similar.
And how did you become such sort of like an expert in it before you even had it? Where were you getting your knowledge at the time? Or
I just don't think I had anything else to do that was that exciting to me. I don't know. I was chasing the dream.
Yeah.
And it's like let's say, you know, you dream of some car or you dream of some location you want to go to. You would just spend days and weeks and months studying everything about it. Like, and you just can't wait till you get there or, you know, till you get that thing and so on and so on and so on. And I was just, that was the case with the XP80 as well. Before, you know, I could persuade my dad to buy it for me, I knew like everything about it. I didn't have the manual, but I had the list of waveforms, effector waveforms, and I knew which waveforms I would use when I would have it and switch it on. So that was pretty ridiculous. I don't know.
No, that's great.
So, I still remember. I would even go to a print shop because I have no. I actually had no computer like in the late 90s, and I would have to go with a floppy disk with the list of preset waveforms. I would go to a print shop. I would, you know, have them print those for me, and I had them literally like on my bedside table, so that I could check them out if I want to, which is like, I don't know. And I was looking at the names of the waveforms and I was imagining how they could sound, which was pretty crazy. None of them really sounded the way I imagined in the end, but that's what I did.
I
think back in those days, because we had so little info coming, you know, upon us, I could say, because no computer, no internet. I had internet in my like an intern room in my university. That's where you could go online, you know, on one of the shared computers. So pretty much everything was in our heads. Like if you had no photo camera, you would memorize, you know, the event. You would keep it in your head. So I think imagination was much more, I mean, memory and imagination was much more important. You know, it was a much bigger part of you in the 90s. Not because of the 90s themselves, but because we didn't have all of this tech, you know,
right,
in our pocket, on our table, in our bag, everywhere. Like right now, it's pretty much like augmented for us. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? We have like our visual memories augmented by the photos on the phone, and so on. All of the things we kind of delegated part of our brain activities to computers. Mm-hmm. So I guess back in those days, that's how I think I developed, everything. It was just stuff happening in my head, which was almost feeding on itself. It's like you feed it a little bit and it would then start creating what it wanted to create, because it had nothing else to do. You couldn't go online and watch someone else do something. You would have to do it yourself, for yourself.
That is very cool.
I couldn't go and watch someone jam with a synthesizer online. Right. I had to go and jam with my own synthesizer. So it was kind of, you would be spending time being creative, being imaginative, no matter what, because that was the only thing you could do, actually.
Now, of course, nowadays, there are so many resources to learn synthesis and sound design. And for our listeners, if you're interested in learning how to design your own sounds with a synth, I highly recommend Syntorial, a super effective course that we here at Audible Genius created. It'll take you by the hand and start from the very beginning, showing you how to program a synthesizer. And it comes with a built-in soft synth that you'll make hundreds of sounds on as you progress through the course. By the end, you'll be making your own sounds intuitively and completely by ear. And for our loyal podcast listeners, you can get 20% off Syntorial this month with coupon code DSP. Check it out at syntorial.com. And were you playing in bands or anything like that with your synth, or is it more just like at home kind of experimenting and things like that?
No. I did a few performances, like paired with a DJ in a few clubs, but it was a bit difficult because I was just a student. I didn't have a car, and you know, paying for a taxi wasn't really an option either. So I would have to literally just ask my dad or ask somebody who had a car to help me transport the instrument to the club. So I didn't do it that much. But I was mostly producing. So I was doing sound design and production. And basically the timeline was, as years passed, I was using more and more of my own sounds in the music. So, I started doing like 50-50, then I switched to only synth sounds and sample drums. And later on, I would start designing my own drums and using only those. So It's not like I've ever released anything. I'm just saying I was trying to, make myself do everything, you know, every aspect of the production had to be in my control. Okay. That's how I ended up doing DSP, because I was like, oh, it's like in the anecdote with the drums, if you know it. I ended up, I've learned the synthesis engine. Now I know everything about it. I've learned all of the effects. Now what to do next? I thought I should create my own then. you know, if what you have is not enough, why don't you go and do something, you know, in that field?
And so is that, so that's that curiosity about like exactly how these effects are being made, how the synth engines are being made. That's what led you to start making your own plugins.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I'm now tracing it back to those times. And when I was using those Roland instruments, the effects back in the day were so incredible. You know, all of the filters and, you know, distortion, choruses, you know, reverbs and everything. I liked them so much. And they were a huge mystery for me. I was like, how do they do those? And I was imagining like, I was, you know, the authors of these algorithms were like superhumans to me. Like, who can create those? Like, how I'm like, it was like a miracle for me. And now that, you know, there is a Dreadbox Typhon, which has my effects on it. And it, only like a few years after we did that one, I realized, wait a sec. 20 years ago, I was like marveling at the effects built into a synth. Now there's a synth with my effects on it, and I didn't even realize it. That, oh wow! So it actually happened. I'm now one of these superhumans, I guess. So it was pretty amazing. I didn't think about it. Like it wasn't mm-hmm. it was never a goal. I just traced it back to those days when I was stunned by these instruments and suddenly realized, oh, I'm actually doing this kind of stuff myself now. So
when you decided that you wanted to start learning DSP, which for our listeners is basically like coding audio, right? The specific stuff that actually makes the effects and the synths to the sound, that part of the code. How did you go about learning that?
Initially it was just a lot of experimentation because, I think I was still a student back when I started playing with, doing, you know, audio processing. I think, it was like, basically around those same years, like 2004, 5, something like that. That was just after I graduated. And since my major was in physics, I had a pretty serious background in all of these, you know, waveforms and waves, electromagnetism, and these things. So, but I was mainly educated in radio waves, not in audio, although my dad used to be an audio engineer. But just the background in math and general understanding of how waves propagate, what happens when they reflect, when they sum, when there's distortion, like nonlinearities, when they propagate. These things, I understood them like... It was like an alphabet for me. I could, you know, it was second nature. So once I think back in those days, I started, that's right. I actually started playing with Linux back in those days. And it had a very basic plugin format. I think that's how it started for me. I started playing with the initial project, which was super, super basic. And once I saw how audio is being fed into the plugin and out of it, and hey, that's the bit where in, you know, the bit in between is what happens to the sound. So I started, you know, the obvious things, creating my own amplifier. That's what everybody does in the beginning, just to gain control. Right. And then I started thinking about, I was somehow obsessed with sine waves. That's where the company name came from, Sine Vibes, because the sine wave was always the basis of all of the formulas that we've had, in physics. I, you know, I knew that that was like the origin of everything. So to me, working with signs meant that you're working with the most fundamental part of sound, whether that be, harmonic series or just a single sign oscillator, or you would use, I thought it would be cool to use the sine wave to shape another sine wave. So that's how I came up with my wave shapers in the beginning. I was essentially playing with them, playing with signs as both the source of sound and the distortion algorithm and so on. So that's basically how it started. I think, once again, a lot of it was just my imagination. I was just dreaming things up, so to speak. And that's how we started.
And so you're making plugins for yourself, but at some point you decided to start Sine Vibes, which is the company you run, which you make and sell plugins. At what point did you decide, I'm gonna turn this into a company, into a livelihood?
Well, Sine Vibes started, I had like four or five different brands that I used to sell my own sound packs first.
Okay.
And those were pretty successful. Then, I switched to Sine Vibes as the final name for those sound packs.
Okay.
And for 4 or 5 years, that was the only type of product that I sold. But again, I first started with presets for hardware instruments, and then I started doing presets for software instruments. And then again, as I was using those, I was like, hey, I'm kind of bored with the stuff that everybody's doing. I should do something I think is worth doing and is absent on the market. So I started playing with a plugin template on the Mac that I had, at that moment. And the first thing that I did was I took those wave shapers that I experimented with back in the Linux days, and I basically took that idea a little further, added modulation. And that was the first plugin that you released. It was like a wave shaper, which you could modulate the curvature of the effect would be kind of dynamic. And it was modulated by a couple of LFOs. So that was the first plugin that I did.
That's cool.
So, but again, I don't know. It's not like, I didn't come from a standpoint, oh, how do I make money?
Mm-hmm.
Rather like, oh, I have this idea. What if somebody likes it, it actually pays for it? But it's usually like I have to build it first without knowing whether it's going to succeed or not.
Yeah.
I have to try. So it's never like, what's trendy now? Oh, what do producers need, these days the most? It's mostly like, oh, I have this idea. Let's try to make a product out of it. So in many ways, I would say the stuff that I'm doing now is kind of up with the times, because I'm always listening to modern music. And I'm kind of hearing, I'm like, how they say it now, vibing with it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, I'm getting inspired by different character of sound, different types of stuff, different ways people manipulate sound.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't try to copy what's being done, but I get like in the same, I would say, stylistic mood as these tracks are made, and it kind of shapes my overall like feeling of what needs to be where a certain algorithm needs to be, sonically.
So then, rather like rather than follow trends or make plugs that you think are going to be popular, it's more about what's inspiring you at the moment, like what you think would be really interesting and musically interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Usually it's actually in half of the time, actually, weirdly enough, the plugins that I think are just a little too simple, they become way more popular than the ones that I would be, you know, sweating myself, calibrating and stuff. You know, like this year, for instance, the plugin that I've released called Skew, which is a reverser, and which is like, you know, there are many reversers out there, but mine had a very simple way to bend the playback curve, so you could have various interesting like scratch effects and pitch bend effects, just like with a single knob action, and that one sold like crazy compared to other plugins, which took maybe like five times more effort to develop. So it's never, yeah.
That's interesting.
And you never know until you try. So you never know until you release something.
Yeah, I was looking at Skew, and that is really interesting. It plays the audio back live, and it even had like a rhythmic component to it where you can sort of change the rhythm of how, or like the time signature of how it plays it back.
The thing is, like, traditionally, people think of reversers as reversing just your standard like quarter note, eighth note, half bar, full bar, two bars, which is most people will go for that. But since I always get these requests by people, oh, please make it go 7/9 or 5/13. I'm like, why would you want that? Like. But I thought, who I am to decide what rhythm people want to play? Mm-hmm. Like, why would it's just like just a UI element? Why would I not include that? You know, if you deliberately have to limit the plugin to certain numbers, I've decided not to. So it goes from 1/16 to 16 bars, and you can pick any value of the fraction that you want. It's as simple as that, and it keeps it synced to the DAW still, but it lets you do these very interesting kind of glitchy things. And when you apply the playback curve onto the reverse chunk, and if you mix it with the original, it kind of makes like a chorus effect as well. And that chorus is going to be, is going to be pretty, it kind of locked to the rhythm, which is also quite interesting. So a lot of hybrid effects are possible when you just, you know, push it a little further from what users expect.
Yeah, that's one thing I noticed about your plugins is that even, a typical plugin, like say a reverb, like you have one called Albedo, it's not a typical reverb. Like I was listening through some of the examples and it's really cool. It's like this almost intentionally artificial, sort of strange or interesting, beautiful sounding reverbs. Is that kind of one of your intentions with each one, to do some element that isn't typical?
Oh, definitely, yeah, yeah. Okay. There are definitely things. It's not like they just come as ideas. Mm-hmm. That's all I can tell you. It's not like I have a whiteboard and like, you know, bullet point number 5, make it original, right? Like come up with a parameter that nobody else has. Right. So that's never really something that I have to like make myself do, but rather, you know, anytime I do something, I come up with an idea that's just pushes it a little further than it has been pushed before, if there was this type of effect. For instance, one of the things which is pretty, it's so basic, it's so simple that, you know, speaking about it is like, what is in it? Like, okay. But for instance, in the hollow reverb, what I did is usually in reverb, you have a pre-delay parameter. So it delays the delay tail it delays the reverb tail so that it happens a little further in time after the sound starts. That's how you can kind of separate it from the sound a bit and not make the mix too muddy. Especially with big sounding reverbs, it's a very important feature, because otherwise, you know, every note you play is going to be mixed with the reverb instantly. So the pre-delay kind of basically shifts the whole audio timeline of the wet signal. And then I thought, why don't we have a sort of like a negative pre-delay? That would mean we're not delaying the reverb signal, we're delaying the dry signal. What happens is that the reverb starts sounding first, and it kind of fades into the original sound. So it almost sounds like both a reversed and an usual reverb, especially when you have a diffusion stage on. It's almost like you are adding a separate attack portion to the note, and then there is a reverb after that. So yeah. It's kind of like, and so it's almost silly talking about it, because it's such a basic idea. Yet, like, I haven't seen it anywhere else. Well, now people,
I've never heard of a negative pre-delay,
which is like super basic. So.
Do you ever get a sense from the people that are using it, whether they're using specific features like that or not? Do you have any idea like how popular certain aspects of your plugins are?
Well, I've only heard comments like, oh, it's such a small thing, but it changes, you know, everything.
Oh, wow.
Because usually you would have to, you could do it before that manually. You would have to have the reverb on the send track, for instance, or like, you know, do a duplicate track, right, and you would leave the the return signal as it is, and then you would delay the original. And I believe many productions did that. Now, that's how the true reversed reverb is done.
Okay.
You reverse the audio, send it to a reverb, reverse it again. That's how the reverb sounds before the signal.
Got it.
But you always have to do it manually. So in this one, it's not the reversed reverb, but it's the attack portion of the reverb that can precede the dry sound.
Okay.
So it still sounds a bit different, but once again, I mean, it's so basic. So in any plugin that I've designed, there's always this something that's, oh, it's taking things further a little bit. So not at all of them, I don't think so, but I'm not really trying to push myself into doing that, but it's just a nature for me to come. So sometimes you come up with something, you say, oh, I'm a genius, but then you discover somebody did it like 10 years ago, like, oh, I should have read the internet more. But you're kind of proud that you came up with the idea, but it's useless because it's been done.
Right.
So
it sounds like you're able to really tap into like the more creative musical side of your brain when you're developing these plugins, even though, you know, coding, it can be a very analytical process. Do you ever find it's kind of tough to use both those sides of your brain at the same time, or is it kind of a fluid process for you?
I think it's always a mix of things. I wouldn't, you know, I'm not really a developer in the sense that I can concentrate in coding for a very long time. Usually it's a lot of imagination, trying to imagine how things would work in my head, than doing a prototype. And the prototype would always be rehearsed. So because I'm doing these things mostly alone, I mean, I have a co-developer, Steven, who is doing things, but, you know, he's done a few DSP bits back in the day, but that was his task. He was doing it alone with no input from myself. Same thing with me. I would, since I'm the one who, let's say, gives the verdict to how the code sounds. I do it like in real time. So I kind of lead the algorithm in a way I think it should go. So, and I don't just do like basic tests, with some basic waveforms and stuff. I actually have recordings of like drums, synths, electric guitar that I keep feeding into the algorithm all the time. Okay. So I would do some changes and feed these different types of audio sources and see what it does. And I kind of try to balance everything on the way. So it's not like I would spend an hour doing something and I would then have to show the output audio to somebody who would say, oh, it sounds good, and tell me where to go next. It's always, because it's all within me, I just sit like this for hours, okay. And I just go somewhere. So the sounds that I use as the sources, they kind of lead me to you know, that destination, you know.
Yeah, that kind of, I can relate to that, having that sort of just that automatic connection between listening to and just hearing what it does musically, and also being the person who's coding it. Like, those two things to be fully informed of each other because they're in one brain is incredibly valuable. Do you ever send out early stuff before it's released to some musicians or people that try it out just to see another perspective?
Very rarely, honestly speaking.
Yeah.
Mostly because, you know, all of the guys that are like in my vicinity, my friends, they are very busy people. Mm-hmm. So there are extremely like high level professionals. Mm-hmm. The ones that I would love to hear from, mostly not like some people that would sign up for your beta testing list. I would say it like that. But they are so busy that I almost never hear anything from them. So pretty much nobody gets to hear the plugin before it's released. So, I would send demos and I would actually publish a teaser audio on our social media. And basically, I kind of gauge the excitement of the users to see, you know, if to see like, oh, am I doing something interesting, or people find it a little boring. So, and it's not like I really analyze it. It doesn't really shape the final product. But let's say most of the time people are actually excited, and it helps me, like, you know, drive, helps drive my, you know, development process to actually finalize the products and, you know, focus on the process.
Which plugin is the most popular one, or gotten the biggest response?
In terms of the number of sales?
Sure, yeah.
Skew.
Okay, oh,
which
really?
Is like, yeah. Huh. So I'm just saying it's sold in 9 months, it sold as many copies as Albedo did in 2 years. Wow. So it's selling like almost three times the rate. Which is, I mean, it's not a shame because it's my product, right? Mm-hmm. But it kind of is a shame because Albedo took way more time to develop. In, you know, conceptually, it's a much more complicated product. But I'm just saying, not everyone wants a sophisticated product. Right. So somebody just want to have some fun. Right. Yeah, that's what Skew is. It's like, it's stupid fun.
Yeah,
I've done. Quite a few demos in the past few weeks.
Okay.
And we actually released an update for it with more curves. And yeah, it's been received so well again. And I kept doing these demos because I couldn't stop. Anything I throw into it, it's just like it just makes it, it's just fun. I don't know.
I can see that. It's more like apparently fun. Like, it's obvious how enjoyable this plugin would be and what it's going to do.
Yeah.
Whereas,
yeah,
like, it's like a reverb. Kind of. Like, I know where I need a reverb, but maybe I won't really enjoy it until I'm using it.
Honestly speaking, yeah. I developed the reverser algorithm to have it as part of our DSP collection for licensing, and I wasn't intending to release a reversal like at all, because everybody has it. You know, why would we have the reversal? You know, it makes no sense. But then at some point, I was like looking at the playhead, the math, and I was like, what if we curve it? What if we bend it? What if the time was nonlinear? So, and I mapped it to like an exponential curve, and I was like, ooh, that's a product. so then I started like coming up with other different curves, and it just developing it was immense fun.
Oh, cool.
So you never know. You never know.
Now, your plugins can also be, you know, people buy them, load them into their DAWs like we do all plugins. But you can also load them into certain Korg synths, like the Minilog XD, for example, which I have right behind me.
Oh, cool.
And I guess I wasn't fully aware of just how much stuff you can like plug into it. I wasn't really aware there were these plugin architectures that Korg lets you put into some of their synths. Is making your plugin compatible with that significantly more work, or is it a whole separate thing?
I would say it is a whole separate thing, because you cannot really like port a plugin to this architecture for two reasons. First of all, there's very limited resources on this platform. I'm talking about like memory and okay. processing capabilities. And the second thing is obviously the format is way more basic. So you don't have as many parameters.
Okay.
So you kind of have to be, I would say, you have to be more inventive to come up with something that's, let's say, radically different from your standard delays and choruses
okay.
And filters. And I like this platform for these exact reasons, that you have to, you really have to push yourselves to come up with something that's significantly more interesting than the standard stuff.
Huh.
At the same time, it actually is able to run on this platform. Did I say playform?
I think so.
It is a playform because you're playing with it. So, and honestly speaking, I try to spend like 1 month focusing on the desktop, on a new desktop plugin.
Mm-hmm.
And the next month I would focus on a new Korg plugin, because each of these kind of draws me in. And if I make Korg plugins for too long, I can actually forget that the desktop plugins exist.
Okay.
It's just so rewarding to, it's kind of the tactility that we were hoping to get from plugins with touchscreens, but it's a huge difference still, because you have these components in a hardware instrument with no notification center, with no Safari,
right.
And none of that stuff. So, and it's pretty incredible that this platform actually got developed. It's just super fun.
Do you find
you
have to work within limitations there, like you were talking about. Do you find that's kind of relieving in a sense, where, you know, when you're making a plugin for a desktop, it's unlimited what you can do essentially, but then when you're mm-hmm. suddenly forced to work within limitations, it's kind of a relief in a sense?
Yes, in a sense it is. I mean, if you have a list of 100 things you can do, what exactly do you do? I mean, if 90% of those cannot be done, like period, it's too much, then you have 10, which is like, wow, you can actually start doing something, because you've crossed out, you know, everything else. You can focus on these things.
Mm.
So it's exactly that. So, and it's actually, you know, a funny thing, there are plugins which allow you to embed samples in them with very low quality, obviously, because mm-hmm. there is a limit to there's the size limit of the plugin itself, which can be only like a couple dozen kilobytes. So how much sample data can you embed into that? And I've played with the idea of embedding some samples just for fun, but then I thought, because the code, you can actually have way more sound generating code in there. Why don't I try to do something else? Because I wanted to do something like a drum synth, mm-hmm. and I thought, okay, why don't I use that memory where the samples could be, actually as the memory to hold the presets? So I created a synth engine, which is like which is able to kind of reconfigure itself in real time. Depending on which key you press, it would load up a preset from that memory. Oh. It would kind of configure itself in real time and play that preset. So, and each preset is something like 35 parameters. Some of them are like, it's actually a bit more because some of the parameters are bipolar. And for instance, if it's positive, it's one filter type. It's low pass filter. If it's negative, it's a high pass filter. So that you're using like each bit of memory to max out what you can do. So that's how I made Groove, which is essentially like a multi-timbral bass and drum synth. So instead of, you know, embedding, a bunch of lo-fi samples, I've actually embedded a preset bank with almost 100 bass, drum, and percussion sounds. So that was quite an achievement that platform, because it's cool. It's pretty much like what you would do in late 80s, I believe, with that kind of limited RAM and CPU power. So, and that is, I mean, it's so rewarding to have this kind of stuff, because there is so much trickery you need to come up with for that stuff to make work. So that it's a completely different type of enjoyment for the developer. I mean, compared to the desktop, where you can be pretty much like lavish with the resources. We can run 100 oscillators. Nothing going to happen.
That's fascinating. So it's one synth engine, but you've programmed a bunch of different drum sounds with the synth engine, and it just switches between those sounds depending on which key you play.
Yeah, exactly.
That's really
so
cool.
So you have the note information coming in, so you can logically split the keyboard into zones. Mm-hmm. And then your parameters, the parameters of the plugin are not the parameters of the synth engine. They just keep saying, oh, preset number one or number 7, whatever. So, and that bank of presets, each of them is holding the parameters for the synth engine. So you've picked your sounds, and then, you know, depending on the key you press, it decides what to do. So some of the zones are chromatic, some of them are not. So it's kind of like a little groove box in the synth. So that was pretty much the biggest technical achievement for me on that platform, because it took it to that kind of level.
Yeah, that's cool. Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
No.
I just noticed you have another one for FM synthesis, and that one really kind of blew my mind, because, you know, I bought this MiniLog XD, you know, okay, this is a subtractive synth. You know, it's got a wavetable thing, but for most part, it's a subtractive synth. That's what this synth is. And then suddenly I'm looking at your plugins. I'm like, wait a minute, I can actually turn this into an FM synth. Like, that idea is crazy in a hardware synth.
Yeah, yeah. That one was also, yeah, very nicely received by the public. I believe it's actually the second best-selling plugin after SKU.
Really?
So, it sold better than all of the other desktop ones. So, wow. Yeah. Node was like, people could not believe what they got, because it's essentially now it's a plugin. Initially, like Korg was saying, oh, you could have an oscillator model in a plugin, and I was like, oh, that's great. Like, you can have like a super saw, you could have like custom noise generator. But then I was like, why does it have to be like just a waveform? I mean, if I started like layering oscillators, trying to run more and more and more, it was able to run more. So I was like, oh, it can be a complete, you know, self-contained synth engine. So that's how pretty much everything was developed. It was the thinking was not to treat it as a bunch of different waveforms, mm-hmm. but a complete synthesis method. That's really like a, you know, that's a synth engine on its own.
Yeah.
And Node was I almost like I've never thought I would do it, but I give it a go, and I was like, I just have to do it now because it had to be done. I'm like, people need this. Like, how, because I'm myself not really into FM that much. Mm-hmm. But I was like, I think people will be like amazed by what this can be within this instrument.
Yeah. Cause it's
so
it,
that drove me like, I want to see what people think of it. And I started, obviously, you know, it's not like I wasn't developing it in the same way I did the others. You know, like I had to like the sound of it, and it had to be designed. I had to pick which parameters to have there, how to configure them for the user. But yeah, the end result was quite good.
Yeah, because you know, FM synthesis is such a distinctly different sound than subtractive synthesis. So to think that you can change your hardware synth in such a profound way is, I guess now I'm not surprised that it was so popular, though. I know it's hard to predict that stuff ahead of time.
Yeah, yeah. It's not like FM is trending. I have to build this thing now. So although it was trending at that time, but to me it was like a bunch of check boxes. Mm-hmm. I was like, I want to have as many different engines on this platform as possible. So we have wave shaping. We have physical modeling. We have FM. Mm. We have this kind of like percussion slash bass machine, and then a year ago we released Odds, which was a completely. I mean, it the concept of the plugin came from a different type of thinking. It wasn't coming from, what type of synthesis engine do we do? It's like, how do we control it? How can we control this engine in a way that others are not, you know, doing? So I'm not sure if you've tried it or read about it. Odds actually has a bunch of different engines. Like it has virtual analog, it has FM, it has a lot of other stuff going on, but the way you control it is a bit different. I mean, you have 80 different engine configurations which you can pick. So let's say, it's a saw waveform with a square waveform going into a low pass filter. That's your configuration number. I don't know, 5.
Okay,
you have to look up that stuff. I don't remember. So, and then you have a couple of parameters which control like the envelope time, the cutoff frequency, oscillator detune, things like that. Mm. And then it kind of sounds basic, right? But then there is a level of control over there that lets you adjust the trigger probability of the sound. It lets you randomize the transposition by octaves and fifth, or just octaves or just fifth. And also allows you to randomize the parameters of the engine, such as envelope time, LFO speed, filter cutoff frequency, FM modulation depth. Like it all depends on what type of engine you've picked. Mm-hmm. So in the end, you have something that makes a different sound with every key press. It's going to be different. So, and if you can imagine like playing an arpeggio, for instance, with just three notes, actually not an arpeggio, you know, just manually, you would play three notes. So, and you have 50% chance of the note sounding, and then the key is being transposed by plus or minus an octave, sometimes, not for every press. Wow. So, and you start getting this, like, it's almost like a generative pattern, you know, the way you know it from modular sequences. But it's built on the sound engine level here, not on the sequencer and modulation level. So in the end, you get like a, I don't know, I've heard so many amazing pieces of music made with it. It's ridiculous. It's like people just push a chord and just listen for a minute. It takes to
Wow.
Make music with it.
So they pick a synth engine, whether it's like FM or subtractive or wavetable, and then with each key press, it essentially randomizes the patch in a sense.
Yeah, yeah. But you control everything. Like there is a table of settings that you can pick, and you pick exactly which parameters you want to be randomized.
Okay. Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. And you adjust the trigger probability with the knob.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So,
then you
pick the transpose pattern. Okay. You also choose it. Is it octaves? Is it fifth? Is it both? And how many octaves exactly, plus or minus? There are 80 engine configurations in there, and about 20-25 ways you can use the transposition and randomization of the parameters.
Wow! So it's like a really
for each. So like if you multiply those, there's like thousands of ways this thing can be played.
Wow. I love that probability thing where you can say, pick one parameter and say just how much you want it to randomly change, if at all. If you want wide range of change or a narrow range of change.
Yeah, yeah. This feature was actually introduced with Groove, the drum and bass engine, because you can actually set any of the zones to a 50% chance of being triggered.
Okay.
So this means that you can have a bass pattern going on, then the kick and snare would play all the time, but then like the hi-hats and the shaker, for instance, they have a 50% chance of being triggered. So it was this idea to overcome the limitation of the Minilog XD sequencer, which is only 16 steps. So you can have longer patterns. But if you put the hi-hat on all of the steps, for instance, all of the 16 steps, and then you engage 50% probability. That pattern will loop, but will never repeat. So it's going to be less boring, basically.
Yeah. A quick word for our listeners. This tool that Artemy has designed is a really cool way to generate drum patterns. It's useful and fun to have a machine randomly composing drum patterns for you. However, you may find that at some point you want to compose your own drum patterns. To learn how to do this, I highly recommend another super effective course of ours called Building Blocks. It'll take you step by step through the process of writing the building blocks of beats, like drum patterns, but also bass lines, chord progressions, and melodies. And it all takes place in an actual online DAW where you create music as you go. And for our loyal podcast listeners, you can get 20% off Building Blocks this month using coupon code DSP. Check it out at audiblegenius.com/buildingblocks. So what's next for you, either with the company or with work outside the company? What do you have plans on?
I plan to work as little as possible for other companies, honestly speaking.
Oh, yeah.
In the past few years, I've been like mostly doing licensing. Mm-hmm. Haven't done much consulting or sound design.
And real quick, licensing is where another company, another developer will pay you to use your algorithms in their products.
Exactly. Okay. Because you can look. I won't drop any names, but there have been many significant products released in the past 5-6 years that used the DSP that me and Steven did.
Okay.
So and it's been very it's been a very good experience. First of all, because I mean I because it's an honor to be part of these big products. On one hand, on the other hand, it makes the development. I mean, we need to make the code more fit. You know, when you're doing it for yourself, it can be a bit messy, right, not too standardized. But since we started doing licensing, we had like three or four major iterations of the code when we would like revise everything maybe once a year, okay, go through everything. Okay, what needs to be improved? What needs to be optimized? What kind of coding practices we can apply that we've learned recently and they work really well and so on and so on. So it's a way to keep your code healthy for years. Mm-hmm. And you get your code in front of high-end developers working for like top companies. So if something is wrong, you will know about it very quickly. Okay. So it's a way to have, you know, some sort of additional discipline when doing stuff, extra checks, being extra focused. So it kind of pays back in the form of having extremely stable code. Like, I will tell you one thing. Since we've launched the new lineup with Mac and Windows plugins 2 years ago, a little over 2 years ago, I haven't heard about a single crash in 2+ years.
Really?
No, not a single crash.
So because your code has gotten so clean for the other developers that are licensing, your plugins perform better for the musicians that are using them as well.
Yeah. You cannot shame yourself in front of these big guys.
Right.
It's not like I wasn't taking care of the code before that, but just like it's like taking the extra steps to make the API more beautiful, more compatible between different algorithms. I think I'm at a point where I don't need this licensing to make me more disciplined. Mm-hmm. I've already trained myself enough, I would say. So, but I think it's that part of licensing has made the biggest influence on what I do. Then there's, you know, getting the money from that licensing. So it's actually collaboration and upping your standards and these things.
Very cool.
So, but yeah, I'm very much focused on doing new stuff. And there are like, I would say, three different directions where we're going. So one of them is, obviously, there's so much new stuff, you know, that we would like to do. I mean, all new DSP that hasn't been released yet. And there's a new plugin that I'm working on at the moment, which is pretty interesting. It's kind of a mixture of diffusion and 3D spacing. So it's like diffusion that can happen in a kind of like a binaural way. So, and it's probably going to be called like a binaural diffusion plugin. Mm. So it's very interesting because I've taken this kind of pseudo three-dimensional stereo with the fact that we've used in Hollow, for instance. And some people described it that it's wider than the wide. So it kind of sounds like a wide effect, but also kind of sounds a little bit like on the inside. So it almost like when you listen to it through headphones, it sounds like the reverb is both encapsulating your head, and it also kind of sounds like here. Like you can almost like feel the thickness of the reverb like around and in your head. I don't know. It's a weird way to describe it, but that's how it feels. So I applied the same idea onto a diffusion algorithm. So and it spreads the signal in this kind of you know, almost three-dimensional way. It's very interesting. It sounds, and when that effect is modulated, is also quite interesting, because it's not a course, it's not a phaser, it's kind of like, you will have to hear it when we release it. So there's some new stuff, but also there's a lot of, like 80% of my sketches and notes is the next generation versions of a lot of plugins that we have discontinued 2 years ago.
Okay.
For instance, like the fraction slicer, multi-effect slicer, sequential multi-effect sequencer, a lot of other more basic sequencer-based plugins. So I'm taking a lot of time to rethink those. Okay. Like, what do I do to make them really next level? So there's going to be like more, I have to keep them simple still. I don't want to like spoil them with double the features just to warrant, oh, that's right. A new version, you know, just to warrant saying that. So it has to be something that's a huge advancement for those, but at the same time, it only takes like 5% more UI space. So the, you know, I have a lot of ideas. You just have, you know, you just have to shape it into a product for each and every one of them. So that's, you know, a lot of users are asking for those, obviously. Mm-hmm. So we kind of abruptly discontinued that line, which was very weird for a lot of people. To me, it was a way to say we have a fresh start, and it was a way to say we're not going to sell you the old stuff. We're only going to sell you the new stuff that's like super, super new.
Right.
So we don't want you to pay for plugins that are like 10 years old. It makes no sense to receive money for those. We want, you know, your money in case of a plugin is like really new, and we will support it for, you know, a lot of time. It's not like we're not supporting the older plugins. We've released new Apple Silicon compatible builds. Mm-hmm. And a lot of bug fixes as well for those half a year ago, and we will continue doing so. So it's not like those are forgotten. It's most like those are in maintenance mode, not in like feature update mode. So, and we actually shipped 5 or 6 plugins as free updates. So some of the products which we released like 6 or 7 years ago, we had V2 releases for those. And there were free updates. So for those who, and there will be more free updates as well. Not for all of the plugins, but for some of the older plugins. Some of the owners of those old plugins will be very happy to know about it.
Cool.
Yeah. So and this third thing, obviously Korg. So there's still a lot of stuff they want to do. I think most of the effects that we did, and actually most of the older oscillators that we released like 3 or 4 years ago, those will be all upgraded. So we will rethink like we've learned a few things in the past, let's say a couple of years, where we can take things a bit further. So we will be doing that for each plugin, kind of rethinking. So where do we exactly run out of CPU power? We will take the plugin to that level until it overloads the system.
Push the limit.
Then we dial back a little bit, and that's the new release. So we try to push it like to the very max. So sometimes it's a bit too much, you know, we have to really dial things back. We get too excited. But that's because like we have, you know, there's a certain limitation on, let's say you have your RAM on the chip, and there's a limit to how many times that RAM can be called for each sample. That's why you cannot run, for instance, 2 reverbs at the same time, because they use a lot of memory access. And if you'd run 2, you would not be able to, because the RAM can only be, you know, it has its bandwidth. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so a lot of stuff.
Well, cool, man. Thank you so much for joining me. It's been fascinating to hear, how you got into the industry, but then also how you just sort of maintained this very artistic, inspired approach to making your plugins. And I hope you continue down that road.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I surely will. There's no other way for me, honestly
speaking. That's great to hear.
So, yeah.
All right, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the Audible Genius podcast. Now, as you listen to these musicians' stories, you may find yourself wanting to make your own music. Or maybe you already can, but you feel the need to brush up on fundamentals, fill in some gaps. Well, I've got some super effective and engaging courses that help aspiring digital musicians find their voice and create music they love. And these courses are more than just a series of videos. They have interactive challenges in a music software environment where you actually create music as you go and get real experience. The first course I recommend is Building Blocks, where you'll learn beat composition and music theory in an online music studio. Check it out at audiblegenius.com. We also have Syntorial, an award-winning course on synthesis, where you'll learn how to create your own sounds with a synthesizer. Check that out at syntorial.com. And both of these courses are designed by yours truly and the team here at Audible Genius. So if you've ever had a desire to make your own music, I highly encourage you to check them out. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you on the next episode.